This is January 4th, 2015. And time when attendance at fitness clubs and yoga studios and I guess not Zen Center so far this year. Little smaller attendance than usual for a Taisho. But generally, over the years, it's been pretty much shown that people with the holidays behind them get serious about this matter of self-improvement and the self-development. And so I'm going to talk about one of the key elements of self-development and Zen practice, which is self-control, perseverance, willpower, not as much as we'll hear, skillful means. And I'm going to use as a springboard for these ideas a famous study that was done in the late 60s, the marshmallow test. I'm sure many of the people who are listening to this know about the marshmallow test. But for those who don't, I'm going to outline how it worked and the implications. I'll be reading from a book I've held on to for some years now. Luckily, I don't get rid of all my stacks of articles and papers and books. And this is from the year 2009 in the New Yorker. And it's the article, the name of the article is Don't, The Secret of Self-Control. And so the deal was they took something like 653 four-year-olds and put them in a very small room with just a desk, and they gave them a choice of three popular treats among children, a marshmallow and two other things, and at least with the ones who chose the marshmallow. Here, I'll. And he would tell them, the researchers would tell the kid that they could have one marshmallow. They place the marshmallow right smack in front of them. They could have that one marshmallow, or if they waited for 15 minutes and could avoid eating the marshmallow, they would press a bell, and the experimenter would come running right straight in and give them two marshmallows. This experiment has been discussed for ever since then. This is the late 60s, and because they found that there's some correlation between how they found is that the kids who could delay eating that marshmallow the longest had some greater success in life in various measures, which we'll get to in a minute, as compared to the kids who couldn't delay eating the marshmallow. I'll just read some segments here that gives a better, clearer sense of what's happening here. Footage of these experiments, and I've seen some of this footage, and I'm sure some of you have too. It's really very poignant to see how these kids struggle with short-term versus long-term rewards. Footage of these experiments, article in The New Yorker from 2009 was written by Jonah Lehrer. Footage of these experiments, which were conducted over several years, is poignant as the kids struggle to delay gratification for just a little bit longer. Some cover their eyes with their hands or turn around so that they can't see the tray. Others start kicking the desk or tug on their pigtails or stroke the marshmallow as if it were a tiny stuffed animal. And then this study was led by a Michel. Trying to find his first name. Anyone know his first name?
Walter,
thanks. Walter Michel. Once Michel began analyzing the results, he noticed that low delayers, the children who rang the bell quickly, seemed more likely to have behavioral problems, both in school and at home. They got lower SAT scores. They struggled in stressful situations, often had trouble paying attention, and found it difficult to maintain friendships. The child who could wait 15 minutes had an SAT score that was, on average, 210 points higher than that of the kid who could wait only 30 seconds. They also found that low-delaying adults have a significantly higher body mass index and are more likely to have had problems with drugs. Michelle, they quote him here as saying, young kids are pure id. They start off unable to wait for anything. Whatever they want, they need. But then as I watched my own kids, I marveled at how they gradually learned how to delay and how that made so many other things possible. Another researcher, Jennifer Winters, who's at that same little lab called the Bing Nursery School at Stanford University. She said that she isn't sure that Michelle's marshmallow task could be replicated today. And this is what she says. We recently tried to do a version of it, and the kids were very excited about having food in the game room, she says. There are so many allergies and peculiar diets today that we don't do many things with food. But what Michel's conclusion, based on hundreds of hours of observation, was that the crucial skill, that is to enable kids to delay eating the marshmallow, was the, quote, strategic allocation of attention. And that, of course, is where the Zen of all this comes in. Instead of getting obsessed with the marshmallow, the hot stimulus, refers to the raw craving or desire. Instead of getting obsessed with the hot stimulus, the patient children distracted themselves by covering their eyes, pretending to play hide and seek underneath the desk, or singing songs from Sesame Street. Their desire wasn't defeated; it was merely forgotten. And then Michelle says, "If you're thinking about the marshmallow and how delicious it is, then you're going to eat it. The key is to avoid thinking about it in the first place." So, the strategic allocation of attention. Elsewhere, he talks about, he uses another phrase, which is distracting. The kid's ability to distract themselves. Another word that comes up in this the review of this literature is Sitzfleisch, literally sit flesh, but it means the ability to stick to it, to continue to work regardless of the obstacles, and some have called this Sitzfleisch grit. And no one who's ever practiced Zen needs to be told of the importance of this grit, of sticking to it, which plays out physically in terms of not moving. I've come to feel that not moving at all, sitting stock still during Zazen, is a more important factor than the particular posture that you're sitting in. I don't know, I can't be sure of that, but I do think that if you were sitting in a lotus posture and squirming and scratching, that you wouldn't be able to see, you wouldn't have the mind settle the way it would if you're sitting in a chair without moving a muscle. There's something about literally not moving that settles the mind, brings the mind to stillness. But in addition to the physical posture of sitting still, there's just holding fast to the practice, just persevering in the face of distractions. Which really is distractions, really, using this now, not in terms of strategic use of attention, but the way we usually use distractions is thoughts, mostly. And this all could come under the category of temptations. So the marshmallow was a temptation, of course. And in Zen practice, the temptation is our thoughts, because they can be so tempting, they can be so entertaining, so compelling. What they found with the marshmallow test was that the kids who tried to stare it down failed. These are the kids who sat there and they made it kind of a face-off. All right, it's either me or the marshmallow. One of us has to give in. And they gave in, usually, those. And this also points to the limitations of willpower in Zen practice. Yes, we want to have willpower in terms of not letting the mind run amok, but just sheer willpower is inadequate to the task. What we need is what we call in Buddhism and Zen skillful means, not just this confrontation and standing our ground against the temptation, but finding a way to use the mind skillfully. And that, of course, comes through the particular practice we're working on. The koan, mu, who am I, what is this? The breath. That's our object of strategic use of attention, is the particular practice we're working on. So it always is, it comes down to this matter of how we use our attention. There's a famous story in Zen where someone asks a Zen master, what is the highest truth? And he says, he writes, this is the word attention. And the person says, okay, what else? And I'm running through this fast because most of you have heard this. And then he dips his brush in the ink and writes it twice, attention, attention. And then the guy's getting frustrated, and then he says, what else? And he writes it three times, attention, attention, attention. For the longest time, I thought that what that really meant was a kind of a command. Pay attention. Or wake up. Wake up. Pay attention. Achtung. And it's not absent from it. There's some of that really Zen practice comes down to. But I came to see eventually that it really means how we use our attention is the key thing. It was the key thing in the marshmallow test. It's the key thing in Zen practice. It's the key thing in terms of success in general in life. I'm absolutely convinced. There are two ways we can use attention, just broadly speaking. There's using our attention in a focused way, as we might with a flashlight, holding a flashlight and directing it here or there. And then there's the kind of a lantern kind of attention or awareness, a more generalized panoramic awareness, as a lantern would radiate the whole surrounding area. In this way of the children responding to the marshmallow, they had to find a way to shift their attention off the marshmallow. And they did. They turned their backs on it. They pushed it away. This is the most adorable thing if you ever get a chance to see this on film. They pretend that it's like a piece of wood. They invent songs. Something like only, I think it was only 30% of the kids could do it. They could only 30% could manage not to eat it in those 15 minutes. And it's the same basic challenge when we're sitting. And not only when we're sitting, but first when we're sitting. What's the temptation? The temptation, again, is thoughts. The temptation is to not face, just not steadfastly hold the attention on the koan or the breath. The temptation is to dwell in thoughts, which is our path of least resistance, is just to let the mind drift into thoughts and play with our thoughts. Another way of saying this is the temptation is thinking about oneself, thinking about my practice, my progress. This takes people the longest, it took me the longest time to be able to discern the difference between actually doing the practice, just or just that's the doing of it. To distinguish between that and thinking about how one is doing, where I am in my practice, whether I'm doing well or poorly, how I'm doing compared to other people. This is the absolutely wrong way to go about it. But we do it so unconsciously. And that is where the lantern aspect of awareness comes in, is noticing when we're doing it. That's the hard thing. Because we so easily just slip into thoughts about me and my practice and my progress or my lack of progress or my concentration. We have to notice when we've slipped into that, and then with this flashlight redirect it to the koan or the breath or whatever we're doing. possibly the biggest temptation for people working on a koan is fixing the thoughts on enlightenment. For people who are very, very driven, have a very strong aspiration to come to awakening, it so easily becomes a fixation on the thought of enlightenment, which is a disaster to sit and think about enlightenment or Kensho. Recently, someone in Doksan reported that this is someone new in practice, that they're working on breath practice, but he complained that when the more he stayed with the breath, the harder it was for him to focus on Kensho. we got that cleared up. In a few days, we're starting our annual sesshin in honor of the Buddha's enlightenment. So my thoughts drifted into the Buddha and his own great efforts, and his own temptations when he was on the brink of his great breakthrough of enlightenment, where he had to face Mara's assault. Mara is this mythological great tempter, the kind of Buddhist Satan, and how when he was pretty much emptied his mind completely, he was in a state of absolute bright awareness and vibrant luminous concentration, then he had these really Makyo swoop down on him, where Mara, the evil one, tempted him first with all kinds of seductive images of women calling to him to relax and join them, and then his trump card, Mara's trump card, was doubt. This is always the biggest one, where Mara suggested, how can you come to enlightenment? You don't have it. You're not up to the task. And you can be sure that the Buddha didn't vanquish Mara in the way we think of it, by just, again, having a face-off and somehow dominating, but by not giving his attention to these images and these voices. There it is again, the strategic use of attention. Michel uses this word distraction, and it can be that. It can be a kind of distraction, but really, in Zen practice, you know, it's somewhat, this is a matter of semantics, but in Zen practice, what he calls distraction is really not allowing the mind to dwell on the wrong things, but to get it back to the particular practice we're working on. Strategic allocation of attention is the phrase. The Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree, you can say, is the kind of the ultimate demonstration of Sitzfleisch, of grit, of perseverance, of not moving. And it is by not moving the mind, by not giving way to distracting thoughts and images, that we get through this world of form, that we see through it and we get beyond it. That's really what the verse at the end of the Prajnaparamita means, or it's one way to understand it. Gate, gate, para gate, para sam gate. Gate meaning beyond, 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 far beyond, is seeing through phenomena, seeing through thoughts, seeing through images, and not seeing through them by staring at them, staring at our thoughts, staring at the images, but shifting the attention back to the breath or the koan. Now, this is the Zen way. In Vipassana Buddhism, it is more a matter of looking directly into the thought or the image or the sensation or the feeling, looking into the phenomenon, whatever it is, and in that way, seeing through it. But this is the, as I understand it, this is the main difference between Zen Buddhism and Vipassana Buddhism, is that in Zen, generally, we're swinging that flashlight away from the thought, away from the image, to the full concentration on the breath or the koan. I'm sure the Vipassana way works, somewhat at least. But I have to speak from experience. I know that the other works, the Zen way works, is to just get it back to the breath or the koan, which really means it's just a way of detaching from the phenomenon, the mental phenomenon of the thought or the sensation or the image or the feeling. And just by there, sitting tight, holding the mind steady on the breath or the koan, that we come to see through this world of phenomena. Going to read some more from this article, the New Yorker article. He says, Michel says, what's interesting about four-year-olds is that they're just figuring out the rules of thinking. The kids who couldn't delay would often have the rules backwards. They would think that the best way to resist the marshmallow was to stare straight at it, to keep a close eye on the goal. But that's a terrible idea. If you do that, you're going to ring the bell before I leave the room. According to Michel, this view of willpower also helps explain why the marshmallow test is such a powerfully predictive test. He says, if you can deal with hot emotions, again, the temptation, the craving, then you can study for the SAT instead of watching television. And you can save more money for retirement. It's not just about marshmallows. The author allows the ability to delay suggests that it has a genetic origin. Michel resists such an easy conclusion. This is Michel. In general, trying to separate nature and nurture makes about as much sense as trying to separate personality and situation. The two influences are completely interrelated. This too is squares beautifully with the Buddhist doctrine of dependent co-arising. It's not just this. It's not just that. It's this and that as they co-arise at this particular moment. It's not just personality. It's not just situation or context or circumstances. It's the two together. It's not just nature. It's not just nurture. It's the two together. For instance, when Michel gave delay of gratification tasks to children from low-income families in the Bronx, he noticed that their ability to delay was below average, at least compared with that of children in Palo Alto. And then he says, when you grow up poor, you might not practice delay as much. And if you don't practice, then you'll never figure out how to distract yourself. You won't develop the best delay strategies, and those strategies won't become second nature. In other words, people learn how to use their mind just as they learn how to use a computer, through trial and error. This is a lot of what meditation practice is just finding out what happens when we allow the mind to wander and what happens when we don't allow the mind to wander, when we hold to the breath or the koan, or at least return our attention to the breath or the koan. Trial and error. It also says here in the New Yorker article that Michel has found a shortcut. When he and his colleagues taught children a simple set of mental tricks, such as pretending that the candy is only a picture surrounded by an imaginary frame, he dramatically improved their self-control. The kids who hadn't been able to wait 60 seconds could now wait 15 minutes. All I've done is given them some tips from their mental user manual. Michel says, once you realize that willpower is just a matter of learning how to control your attention and thoughts, you can really begin to increase it. This phrase, mental tricks, prompted in me a sense of the difference now between Zen and Tibetan Buddhist practices. I've talked about Zen and Vipassana Buddhist practices. Well, in Tibetan Buddhism, as I understand it, they have quite a variety of devices, of visualization practices, and other ways of effecting a certain, effecting something in the practice. Creating an effect in the mind. And no doubt that works too, in its own way. But it's not the same as Zen practice. In Zen practice, there are no visualization practices, no devices, such devices. It's just a matter of swinging that flashlight of attention back to the practice you're doing. Once noticed that it's not there. But this sentence of Michel's, once you realize that willpower is just a matter of learning how to control your attention and thoughts, you can really begin to increase it. And this is what happens, of course, through Zen practice. The longer we practice it, the better we get, the more skillful, the more practiced we get at using our attention in the most high-functioning, the most effective way. But it takes practice. So the strategic allocation of attention is the mu or the breath, or in the case of Shikantaza, just this. Is coming back to this, no object of concentration as such, but just this. Another, a further development of this strategic allocation of attention is when it comes to, in the case of a koan like mu, is then to investigate that object of so-called distraction. Investigate the mu. What is it? This is where the element of questioning comes in. This is the best way of getting drawn in more deeply to the so-called distraction. The last thing in the world it is a distraction, of course. When we're absorbed in mu, We're absorbed in direct experience. We're free of thoughts. Mu is not a thought, or it when we are, I mean, it can be. We can conceptualize the word mu, and most people do for years. They make a concept out of it, but when we're truly absorbed in mu, we're free of conceptualization. And the best way to really get drawn into that pure experience, not a thought, but mu as an experience, is to question it. Another psychologist quoted here in this article says, this is how self-control cashes out in the real world, as an ability to direct the spotlight of attention so that our decisions aren't determined by the wrong thoughts. Zen is more radical than that, so that our decisions aren't determined by thoughts at all, but so that we can draw from deepest levels of the mind, can come into harmony with our true nature. There certainly can be no doubt but that people who are good at Zen practice, that is, who can really stick with it year after year, are going to find greater success in whatever they do. Certainly greater success than they would have without Zen practice, for all of the reasons that these guys are talking about. Stick-to-itiveness, grit, perseverance. Perseverance and patience we may not have a great deal of when we start Zen practice, but they become developed through practice. You can't practice Zen for years and remain impatient, as impatient as when you started. You become more patient. We become more persistent, more steadfast. There are questions that remain. It says here that Michelle showed that children did much better on the marshmallow task after being taught a few mental transformations. Well, we were just talking about this, such as pretending the marshmallow was a cloud. And that they allow in this article is how it remains unclear if these new skills persist over the long term. Another psychologist looked at the relationship between self-control and grade point average. She found that the ability to delay gratification, eighth graders were given a choice between $1 right away or $2 the following week, was a far better predictor of academic performance than IQ. She said that her study shows that intelligence is really important, but it's still not as important as self-control. Think about this. It's too much, maybe until recently, until this study became so well known, there's too much made of IQ as a predictor of success. This and other studies really point to self-control Sitzfleisch. Persistence. The skillful use of attention is more important. Michel says it's commenting on this finding. He says it's not enough just to teach kids mental tricks. The real challenge is turning those tricks into habits, and that requires years of diligent practice. And he says this is where your parents are important. Have they established rituals that force you to delay on a daily basis? Do they encourage you to wait? And do they make waiting worthwhile? According to Michel, even the most mundane routines of childhood, such as not snacking before dinner, or saving up your allowance, or holding out until Christmas morning, are really sly exercises in cognitive training. We're teaching ourselves how to think so that we can outsmart our desires. So again, the importance of nurture, of the environment, of parenting. With a daily practice of meditation, we can make this an ongoing, continuous challenge of finding out how to make our sitting a daily practice. So many people struggle with this. And, you know, in the end, it comes down to whether you feel the need to sit. That's it. Whether you feel the need to sit. But there are some things that seem to foster that need and allow it to grow. I think possibly the best, most important thing is to find a way to sit first thing in the morning. And that too brings us back to temptations, brings us back to the marshmallow and how to not get drawn into that temptation. So what are the temptations? Well, we have more than we've ever had in the history of humankind, I bet, which is we get out of bed to check our email, check the smartphone, check the New York Times, check the computer, check the TV. These are all very strong temptations. So consider focusing on one thing. You get out of bed and you sit. You sit. You delay the gratification of getting into all of these screened pleasures. Try it. Try doing it every day. Making sitting the beginning, the base of your day. It takes some effort not to have your attention drawn into those things. But the more you can do this with a sitting, the better you get at it, the stronger that muscle of just refraining from being drawn into those tapes, the stronger that gets. And if for some reason you can't do it first thing in the morning, then find a way to do it later. Same temptations. Find a way to refrain from getting drawn into them. But in order for Zen practice to work for you, you have to practice it. You have to do it. So self-evident, but I'm not sure how many people who say they do Zen practice actually sit every day or most days. Pain is another example I want to touch on before we close. So the temptation when you're sitting still, you can't move in a formal round of sitting, and you have pain, physical pain, the temptation is to fight it or flee it. That's the marshmallow, fighting or fleeing. If we can refrain from those rather ineffective devices and instead just pour the attention into our particular practice, then we find that the pain can subside. Other things, other pleasures, temptations, food, temptations. Michel, I heard an interview of him recently, and he said how much he loves chocolate mousse, and how he's learned that if he visualizes, when he's at a restaurant and he's looking at a menu that offers chocolate mousse, if he visualizes a cockroach on the chocolate mousse, that works for him. Well, good. If it works, it works. That would be more the Tibetan Buddhist, if I may just make kind of wild generalizations, is using the imagination, which we don't do in Zen, in traditional orthodox Zen. We don't use the imagination or visualization tricks. We just go back to the breath or the koan. I can't resist, speaking of chocolate mousse, telling you a story. This is from my sister Sonia, who's also a Zen teacher at a center in North Carolina, Asheville, who they went out as a family to a restaurant, which was not common, and her daughter, Raina, who was maybe five, I don't know what age, young. And Raina opened one of these menus and gasped when she saw on the menu chocolate mouse. And Sonia was bemused, and she said, "No, Raina, it's mousse. Chocolate mousse!" All right, I guess we better stop.